Colorado River starts in the Rocky Mountains, and for more than 1,400 miles, it wends its way south. Along the way, it's dammed and diverted dozens of times to cities and fields all over the American West. But drought and the tens of millions of people who depend on that river are sucking it dry. This week, the reservoir that supplies Las Vegas, Lake Mead, reached its lowest level in history. By the time the Colorado River reaches the U.S.-Mexico border, only 10% of it is left. At that point, it hits a place called the Morelos Dam and is diverted a final time into Mexican farmland. In other words, Morelos is where you go to see the Colorado River die. Rowan Jacobson is a writer who recently was at the Morelos Dam when something pretty astounding happened. He says that on one side of the dam, it's this lush, green place, and on the other,
it's a surreal landscape. You look south and you just see a trench. Big stretches of it are bone dry. It is just a river of sand at this point. So you just see the riverbed filled with white sand like you'd find at the beach. And that's all that's left of what used to be a vast delta with about 2 million acres of wetlands.
Wow. So then recently, Mexican and American officials agreed and decided to lift the Morelos Dam and let some water flow into that parched riverbed. Why?
It was 15 years in the works, and it's a complicated arrangement. There's a lot of pieces to it. But one part that everyone came to agree on is that it would be a great thing to let a bunch of water go down the traditional channel purely for ecological restoration, which was the first time the U.S. and Mexican governments have done anything like that.
And so you were there when they lifted the dam. Tell us where exactly you were when that happened.
I was directly below the dam, which in retrospect was probably a fairly stupid place to be.
Yeah.
But I wasn't alone. There was maybe a couple hundred of us there. So the gate opened and this little surge came out and we all cheered and we popped some champagne. And then we realized the surge was a bit bigger than we had expected. So pretty quick we had to scramble up a bank to get away from it. But that was a good sign because this was going to be a full-blown river, at least for a few weeks.
So they lift the dam slowly. It starts to look like, wow, this is going to be a river. What was your plan?
We pulled together a small band of river rats and paddle boards.
I mean, this is basically standing on a surfboard and paddling your way through.
Yeah, all day long. The first 22 miles, it actually forms the border with Arizona. So we would be paddling, and we could see the Border Patrol guys off to the side occasionally when the river would curve through there. And they were a little freaked out by the whole situation.
So as you followed the path of the water down, how were people reacting to the fact that this river was coming back after being gone for decades?
Yeah, you know, the end of our first day, we came into this town called San Luis Rio Colorado, which was always a river town until the water dried up. So us and the water arrived in this town that hadn't seen water in decades.
Wow.
And the party had started already. All the kids were waiting there, and the kids started splashing in the water, cranking up the ranchero music, and it was just a huge fiesta.
So water from the Colorado River eventually did reach the sea all the way to the Gulf of California. What's going to happen now? Is that water going to keep flowing?
No, it's done. It was shut off in May. Enough water has been purchased to basically keep a trickle going for the next 5 years to try to keep these trees alive. But it's just a trickle.
I mean, because I think we have to say that we are here in the West in the middle of a major drought. I mean, how can you make the case that this particular project needs water over some other, you know, more bigger agricultural projects, you know, obviously cities that need water?
It's super controversial, and a lot of people think this was about the dumbest thing you possibly could have done with the water. But, you know, 50 times as much water as was released for this project is used for irrigation to make alfalfa, basically, to feed cattle. So if we can just take 1/50th of the water that we use to make hamburgers and milk from the Colorado River, we can have this kind of event every year.
That's Rowan Jacobson, his story about the undamming of the Colorado River in Morelos, Mexico, is in this month's issue of Outside Magazine. Rowan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kelly.
The town of Denton, Texas, is embroiled in a debate over fracking, or hydraulic fracturing, to extract natural gas. Fracking has brought a steady stream of revenue to Denton for years. But this Tuesday, the Denton City Council will consider banning fracking because of environmental concerns. For more, I spoke with Abram Lustgarten. He's an environmental reporter for ProPublica, and he explained what some residents of Denton are worried about.
There are concerns about what happens to groundwater supplies as the fracking chemicals, the mixture that's used, is injected underground at very high pressure. There's concern that it will seep into aquifers, either the methane gas or the chemicals themselves. The process also produces an enormous amount of waste called produced water. Both the fracking chemicals come out of the ground and also water that is contaminated with natural chemicals from deep underground that, you know, once it's brought back to the surface, needs to be dealt with. That waste stream is often reinjected into what are called waste disposal wells.
Speaking of that wastewater being reinjected underground, there was actually a study out this month by researchers at Cornell University and the University of Oklahoma linking that wastewater to earthquakes. Industry is warned about a rush to judgment just based on this one study, but do you see this now shaping the debate?
I do. You know, what's changing with this study is the direct connection of those wastewater injection wells to the fracking process, in that it is waste produced from fracking that is being injected into the wells and causing the earthquakes. Because of that association and the controversy and the news attention to the fracking issue, there is a lot more attention being focused on the cause of these earthquakes. Across the country, though, it's something like the number of seismic events has increased fivefold in the couple of years since the drilling boom really began, since about 2010. Places like Oklahoma have seen these huge swarms of small earthquakes in large numbers.
Now, we should note that the fracking boom has brought the country closer to energy independence. You know, one might even say it strengthened America's hand on the world stage. But do you get a sense that the concerns are starting to outweigh the benefits?
In certain communities, I think unambiguously, local groups' concerns are outweighing their benefits. You know, I've also done some recent reporting in both Texas and in Pennsylvania about the financial side of this drilling boom, looking at royalty payments to the communities where the drilling is happening. And communities are not necessarily seeing or not all seeing the kind of financial income that they would have expected or hoped for. When that happens, at the same time that the environmental risks and the very tangible negative impacts in their communities grow and grow over the years, I think that, you know, there's a tipping of the scales that's happening on a local basis.
But even if individuals aren't receiving any kind of direct benefits from this, this is something that still, you know, goes into state and county coffers and benefits everybody in a way, right?
Absolutely, especially in the state of Texas, which is one reason why, you know, what's happening in Denton is significant. You know, Texas enjoys floating atop this energy boom like no other state. It was largely sheltered from the economic recession that the rest of us experienced after 2008 because of the natural gas drilling boom happening there. You know, and Denton in particular benefited from that boom for many, many years. The drilling happened in the Denton area, began in the Denton area nearly a decade ago. It's well underway at this point.
Abram Lustgarten covers the environment for ProPublica. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We often hear about rising sea levels. There are also chemical changes happening in the ocean. As people put more carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere, the oceans absorb more of it, and that makes the water more acidic. The effects can be tough to spot in most places, but scientists say if this continues, it could be a disaster for marine life. They also say there may be ways to protect plants and animals in the oceans. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
There are a few places in the ocean that are naturally very acidic. Seeps, where carbon dioxide rises out of vents in the seafloor. These could offer a preview of the future. Marine biologist Christy Croker has dived down to see those places. I talked to her about them aboard a research boat in the Pacific.
It's like you're swimming through a glass of champagne where there are bubbles coming up all around you.
But with a shot of vinegar thrown in. And the effects of that acidity are nasty.
It's really striking, and it's not, I think, what people want their oceans to look like. The algae tends to overgrow just about everything, so you get a more monotone, green, slimy ecosystem.
There's almost nothing alive. In the rest of the world's oceans, things aren't that bad yet. But even small increases in acidity are having subtle effects on shellfish, for example.
It takes more energy for these animals to build their shells in more acidic conditions. These are things like oysters or mussels or snails.
Marine biologists are becoming somewhat obsessed with acidification, and some are looking for ways to protect marine animals and plants. Here in California, they've found nearly ideal places to do that. The state has created them, the nation's largest network of coastal reserves. You can see why they have. On the beach in downtown Santa Cruz, volleyball players lunge across the sand courts.
Get up.
Tourists line up for whale watching and dive trips, and kids marvel as glistening seals surface and beg for food. More than two-thirds of Californians live within a few miles of the ocean, but all that love has also brought pollution, oil spills, and overfishing. That's why the state has created 124 protected areas along its coast. Some hug the shore, some are miles out in the ocean. You can't drill or develop in any of them, and you can't fish in about half of them. Ecologist Mark Carr says they were intended to be aquatic wildernesses and fish nurseries.
You're protecting the sources of young that are replenishing those populations along the coast.
Carr studies fish at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says so far the network seems to be helping some species, lobster and blue rockfish, for example. But now Carr and other scientists say these protected areas are like natural laboratories where scientists can study an even bigger problem, one they'd never imagined when they created the reserves, ocean acidification. Here's why. When something affects marine life in the ocean, it's often hard for scientists to pinpoint the cause.
When they see changes in the size of fish populations, to what extent is that driven by fishing, or to what extent is that driven by changes in the ocean climate?
If there's no fishing and fish numbers are going down, then scientists know it must be something else, perhaps acidification affecting the food chain from plankton up to tuna. The value of reserves isn't lost on fishermen either. Some who first fought the idea of reserves, like Bruce Steele, now embrace them. I meet Steele at a beach near Santa Barbara. He spent 40 years scuba diving for sea urchins in these waters.
You have to have some place to look where you can filter out the fishing influence. Otherwise, what would happen? It's so much easier to just blame us. You could just say, it's just the fishermen. We're not really going to take care of these problems.
Scientists from the University of California, Santa Barbara, have already selected a protected area for acidification research. A team has gathered in the cabin of a 55-foot research boat in the city's harbor. They're off for a four-day expedition.
Hi, everybody. Welcome aboard.
Biologist Jay London outlines the trip, a day at Santa Cruz Island, an island near the city surrounded by protected areas. Why this island? Because of the seagrasses here, also called eelgrass. They're underwater meadows, and they do something very curious that's got these scientists excited. The grasses seem to be able to neutralize acidity in the water.
Seagrass beds absorb CO2, and they can buffer acidification. And that's why we're going to the seagrass bed. We want to know where the seagrasses actually are.
If that's true, these places could become refuges for sea life trying to escape acidic water. 90 minutes by boat from the coast, the island is a menagerie of sea life. Team leader Gretchen Hoffman says the plants and animals here have evolved to live in this particular environment around this island. That means they're very sensitive to changes in the chemistry of seawater here. If it becomes more acidic, they'll show it, like living litmus paper.
This isn't just some esoteric little exercise, because we know that organisms are very fine-tuned and adapted to what they've experienced historically in the environment.
Once the boat is anchored near the island, the team lowers a video camera overboard, looking for eelgrass. They watch from a big screen in the cabin.
You want to be right above it?
Yeah.
Okay, we're now in the eelgrass bed. Oh, right there. Did you see that? A giant kelpfish.
Out on deck, Hoffman watches as other members of the team motor back and forth above the seagrass bed in a Zodiac dinghy, taking water samples to check for acidity. It's slow going and wet.
Zodiac science. How many more samples do you have left over?
We've got to do the 10 on the outside of the seagrass bed.
Copy that.
But things perk up when the local wildlife comes over to investigate.
You've got a sea lion coming in at 3 o'clock. Over.
Copy that.
This is what scientists call laying the groundwork. It's slow. It will take years and thousands of measurements like these to see if these underwater meadows really can neutralize acidity in any meaningful way. But Hoffman says there's a lot at stake.
You know, we want to do something to protect our backyard, our part of the ocean, and we're realizing that if these beds of eelgrass are good in that they buffer future changes in acidity, we should be protecting them, or maybe even restoring them.
Or even planting them, something scientists are experimenting with now. In so doing, they could create refuges for fish and plants in a sea world that could become increasingly hostile. Safe places where, as local fishermen sometimes say, the water stays sweet. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
There is a coal-burning power plant outside of Houston that ranks among the nation's biggest emitters of carbon dioxide. With pressure to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the plant is hoping to capture that CO2 and use it to boost energy production in an old oil field. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
Two big energy companies, NRG Energy and JX Nippon Oil and Gas, are announcing the start of construction of the world's largest operation for turning carbon dioxide into something useful. They say the new billion-dollar facility will capture 90% of the carbon dioxide that otherwise would be escaping from the coal-fired W.A. Parish power plant. Instead, workers and equipment will capture the CO2 gas, compress it, and then pipe it more than 80 miles away to the West Ranch oil field near Victoria, Texas. There, the gas will be pumped a mile underground. If all goes as planned, the pressure from that gas will be used to free up oil trapped in rock formations. Arun Banskota is CEO of Petranova, NRG's wholly owned carbon capture business. He says West Ranch currently produces about 500 barrels of oil a day.
Once we are able to get carbon dioxide into the West Ranch oil field, that field will produce something in the range of 15,000 barrels a day.
The project marks the first time an existing coal-fired power plant is being refitted with coal gas capture technology. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Google is trying out one way of mapping climate change. It has outfitted a few of its Street View cars with special sensors to measure methane. WNYC's Robert Lewis rode the streets of Manhattan to see how Google is mapping pollution across the country.
The Subaru hatchback is painted like a Google map. A tower on top holds what looks like a futuristic soccer ball. That's the panoramic camera that takes those photos of buildings and streets you see on Google Maps in Street View mode. That's why when Justin Hagen drives through Midtown Manhattan, a man in a suit jumps excitedly. Some schoolgirls snap iPhone photos, and a guy crossing the street smiles and makes an obscene gesture.
You get a lot of waves, a lot of really excited people think they're going to be famous and on Google Street View.
It's just another day in the life of a Google driver.
It's minor celebrity, but it's more the car than you.
But this car's not taking photos. It's one of three Street View cars outfitted with special equipment to detect methane, the primary ingredient in natural gas. It's part of a partnership between Google and the Environmental Defense Fund that's finding leaks in the thousands of miles of gas mains beneath streets in New York and other cities.
As we're moving, there's a pump that's sucking air from the hose that's right sort of in the bumper, and that's bringing it back to the rear of the car where there's the methane analyzer.
That's the fund's chief scientist, Stephen Hamburg, as he rode along with Hagen on a recent morning. Hamburg is wedged in the back seat because there's a big monitor where the front passenger seat should be. A slow-moving line spikes up when the car's sensor detects methane.
We have to use algorithms to understand, are we passing a bus or that kind of thing, because you can't do that in real time, figure out was that a natural gas bus that went by, or here we've got a UPS fueling station. Let's see if it's, I don't know if they have natural gas here or just petroleum. We didn't see any spike. It stayed at 1.9.
Those readings are pretty normal, but here's what the scientists found on New York's Staten Island.
There was an average of one leak per mile, and that is similar to what we saw in Boston. But in Indianapolis, where they've had a very active program of replacing the old pipes with new pipes, in fact, they have one leak per 200 miles.
Leaks are pretty common in older cities like New York, where a gas explosion in March killed 8 people. But most of the leaks aren't necessarily dangerous. Instead, gas just escapes into the atmosphere. Utility companies haven't really paid a lot of attention to those. Hamburg says they should. Methane from natural gas doesn't stick around as long as carbon dioxide, but it carries 120 times the warming effect. And he says this project will show the spots causing the most pollution.
We can reduce the emissions at a much faster rate than if they were to use their normal approach to figuring out where to repair the leaks and in what order.
So far, utility companies have been cooperating with the scientists, checking the results and sharing information. One utilities spokeswoman says the data will be useful, but that it's too early to say what will change. While the project is relatively small so far, just 3 cars, the researchers hope it's just the start, and with Google's help, plan to look for more air pollution across the country. For NPR News, I'm Robert Lewis in New York.